I'm Stacy Erickson. I'm with Clarkson Consulting, and I'm a director in our life sciences industry. And I focus on med device and pharma, and especially on that clinical to commercial readiness that Bill just spoke about a minute ago. So I'm excited to be here. This is an esteemed panel. You probably know a lot of these faces and names. They've been around BSMA a while, but I'll have each of them introduce themselves. Start with you, Mike.
Hi, my name is Mike Rigoni. I head up supply chain at Vir Biotechnology. I've been in the industry for about 20 years, working at conglomerates like Roche and Genentech, all the way down to a very small company. I've had the opportunity to see both highly commercialized companies all the way down to clinical. Nice to be here.
Hi, I'm Deborah Knoll. I'm with Thermo Fisher. I'm a director in the supply chain group. I started in clinical supplies more than 30 years ago in formulation development for one of the pharma companies that no longer exists because it was swallowed by a larger pharma company, which was then swallowed by Pfizer. So it started in clinical supplies years and years ago, and I've seen loads of changes, and it's been fantastic.
I'm Matt Bloom. I'm at Catalent. I'm part of the operations team at Catalent. I've been there for 25 years. And Bill, I must say I'm a little depressed now to think about the amount of time that I spent on booklet labels over the last years to hear that 90% never get open.
Hi, everyone. I'm Brittany Elko. I'm currently over supply chain and tech ops at Allagos, an early phase small company. I've been at small pharma the last several years. Prior to that, I was at Genentech, but now kind of moved into the small clinical pharma space.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Ryan Mills. I'm head of GMP's supply chain at Denali Therapeutics. I've been there for just about 5 years. I've been in the industry for 15 plus. Also a plug, I'm one of the co-leads for the clinical supply and demand planning work stream. So if you're interested, please reach out. We would love to have you on board.
It's a fun work stream. Okay, so we are going to talk about clinical supply chain strategies, but we're going to focus on that upstream drug substance, drug product here in this conversation. So I think it actually came as a request from last year's BSMA. I remember it coming up. It might have even been
Mike.
Yeah. Brought it up during the conversation. Yeah. And so it was a popular panel, so we'll try to get through and get everyone's view in the time we have and leave some time for questions. So I'm just going to start with a little layup question, and Brittany, it's for you. What is one of the kind of number one challenges you face when you think about DSDP supply planning?
I'm going to speak specifically to kind of the early phase portion of it, because that's what I've been experiencing, and I think for the most part, you're really limited by funding and kind of fundraising milestones to really trigger when you can lock those manufacturing slots and book the API. So that's something that I've come into conflict with is desired FPI versus what we can actually financially lock in as far as manufacturing runs. The other thing I want to highlight is the quantities are kind of determined by the next batch size typically. And so I'm kind of working with what can CMC produce for me versus what's the trial design. And that's something that I think is also the yields are very unknown too. So you're kind of working with a lot of uncertainty in the early phase.
Okay, I'm going to jump to you, Ryan. Maybe you want to talk more late phase then.
Yeah, and I'll pick up where Brittany left off because I think she hit a key word, which is uncertainty, right? And this is the clinical space, talking about art versus science and some of the judgment that we use. I think when we think about demand and supply planning, we can think about it from either uncertainty on the demand side or uncertainty on the supply side. And one of the interesting things as a product matures into late phase clinical trials is the amount of demand uncertainty. I think Bill was alluding to this a little bit in his opening remarks, where you have larger trials that where enrollment rates are potentially unknown, and how do you create an accurate demand forecast for that? So one of the approaches that we use at Denali is a type of scenario planning that we call low case, high case, where we will start with a very aggressive enrollment forecast. This is typically what you get from the CRO or ClinOps, develop a drug product and drug substance supply plan, and then we'll make a judgment. This is part of the art. what happens if enrollment is much slower? What potential excess waste are we looking at from a DP and DS perspective? We can analyze that and then share that with the team for consideration to see if there are modifications that we may want to make, which may introduce some risk to the aggressive forecast, but are there then adjustments that we can make in our plan to account for that? Then the second piece on the supply side, where you also have uncertainty, is as you're scaling up for late phase production, you're often looking at substantial changes to your drug product and drug substance manufacturing process. From a regulatory perspective, is there going to be risk with acceptance of those changes, acceptance of the shelf life that you may have previously established? One of the strategies that we use there is we try to connect our regulatory strategy on the DS and DP side with our finished product and our distribution strategy to make sure that we have clear line of sight to where that product is going, collaborating with our regulatory colleagues to assess that risk, and then making a determination, again, do we need to make adjustments to our plan to try to reduce waste through the supply chain?
Deb, do you want to add anything to these thoughts, challenges?
What's interesting at Thermo Fisher, we get to work with the large, you know, biopharma clients that have been around for years, and then the small clients that have one very precious compound that they're nurturing through the supply chain, and the risk tolerance is much different, and the knowledge base is much different. I mean, I think when you know what you don't know, you know what questions you need to answer, and then you might be in a position where you're still trying to secure funding and you don't know what you don't know, and it changes the way that you are rationing out the materials and trying to feed that upstream supply chain with as much information as possible as soon as possible.
Good themes, and you're gonna see on this panel the great thing is we have different perspectives, so it brings it together, the story. And that, I'm gonna jump into another question because we have perspective of a sponsor and a CMO. So we're gonna talk about what strategies you have in working with your CMOs and getting those commitments early enough for drug substance and drug product. So I'm gonna take the sponsor view first.
Okay.
That's me. I'm going to have mine take the sponsor because, and then Matt, you can defend.
Just a quick poll. How many people in the audience are working for a pharma company and they outsource their manufacturing? Mm-hmm. A fair amount of people, okay. So you probably are familiar with the challenges associated with that, especially if you're a smaller company. And normally the CMO capacity doesn't necessarily align with when you want to get your drug substance or drug product made. And one of the things that we do at Vir is we are, our strategy internally is to be the partner of choice, where we treat the CMO as an extension of our company, a clear partner, and they understand the story behind our products and what we're doing, the research that we have associated with it. They're involved intimately with the tech transfer process, as well as our story around what we're trying to achieve overall clinically. And the relationships are very important to us that we establish, and we find that establishing great relationships from the top down is very important. That allows for flexibility when we need to flex, and I think Ryan mentioned that we have a lot of uncertainty that we're dealing with in the clinical space, so we have updates that we make, obviously, to our clinical protocols. We have feedback that we get after phase one from a regulatory agency, and they help provide us some direction on how to proceed with phase two and phase three. And the reality is things change, right? So we need to have a partner that has some of that flexibility. So as we develop scenarios and we look at optionality, we have partners that can work with us in order to adapt that with the intent that they're not just there to produce a batch for us, they're there to help build a franchise with us. And our goal is to build a portfolio with strategic partners, and the importance of those strategic partners is really monumental for us, given that we're a small fish in a large pond. Number one, number two, we rely on the contract manufacturers to perform with us, not for us, and to have a skin in the game to help us be successful as a company.
Take that, Matt. So, like Mike and Deb said, I think partnership is key. And then, like, if we look at the themes from yesterday around business resiliency, and then we listen to, like, what Bill and Devendra have said about taking action, one thing that is an action that everyone could take from here is to sit down with your partner and say, we want to do a formal risk assessment of the process. So use a simple tool. It doesn't have to be AI driven or anything. It can be Excel. It can be, you just need to say, what are the what's the likelihood of things happening? What's the detectability? And what's the occurrence or the severity? And to say, out of your 1,000-point scale, like, where do you want to set actions? And then make that a living document that you work with your CDMO, you go through with them on a regular basis, whether it's monthly or quarterly. You're looking at excipients, you're looking at formulation, you're looking at blending, you're looking at coding, you're looking at every little thing through there, even suppliers saying, do we have a backup source if something happens? So I think that's an action it's an easy one to do, and if your CDMO is your partner, you should be able to ask them to drive that and own the document, and then and be able to make that part of your regular meetings.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, Ryan or Brittany maybe, do you find it a challenge to get involved early enough? So if supply chain procurement get involved early enough with these key partnerships?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where supply chain has to be an advocate for your function. And I think we're fortunate at Denali, where usually our supply chain team is involved at least 9 to 12 months before first patient in for our first clinical trial. And we see that as a responsibility to speak up and say, we have a stake in understanding what our lead times are, what our capacities are, understanding where the risks potentially are, and how we want to input those into our plans. I know it's not maybe that way in every organization, but for those of you who are in a supply chain function, speak up and advocate and say, this is why we need the information that we need, because the decisions that we're making are multi-million dollar decisions, and we want to get it as sort of as best we can in terms of balancing cost and risk and the needs of our CMOs.
Yeah, I think for later, when I've done later phase, that's very straightforward. What I've seen with the early phase, and I'll talk on this later with the ClinOps piece of it, is that ClinOps are the ones managing those CMOs before they bring in supply chain, and they don't know to ask the questions that Matt's talking about. They don't have that lens of supply chain risk. They just want to make sure that drug's getting to the site, and there's not as much strategy behind it. And so when I've had to come into these situations, you kind of have to start from scratch and build that expectation. And you would hope the CMOs would impose some of it on them a little bit, but again, you know, supply chain owns that, and ClinOps isn't thinking about it. Yeah. So,
it's a good takeaway. I heard it a couple times yesterday. Get involved early with your CMOs if you can. So, it's a good takeaway. I'm going to jump to a little bit different topic. It ties in, but when we think about this DS and DP planning, I think budget constraints, along with kind of risk, comes up a lot. And so, Ryan, do you want to start on that?
Yeah, I think the lens that I have been thinking about this through is the lens of cost, right? And especially as we're a pre-commercial company, there's a huge emphasis on budget and on managing cost. We know that DS and DP accounts for a huge portion of CMC costs, especially if you're in biologics or cell therapy space. So we've been really looking at what are some specific steps that we can take to make sure we have our arms around the budget. So a couple of recommendations here. I think one is understanding your cost of goods. Really working with procurement, with the folks who are managing your CMOs to get a full understanding of how much does each batch cost? How much is drug substance, drug product, all the way through your label pack? And then working that into a process where you're reviewing your drug substance and drug product production strategy across both within a single product as well as your entire portfolio. Another element that we've also worked to understand is what are our planning horizons and our commitment windows? When are we going to potentially incur cancellation fees if we have to move drug substance and drug product runs around? We actually use that information as a trigger to reanalyze our drug substance and drug product strategies. I think it's very common to have sort of a set it and forget it approach. Okay, we're going to make two batches, this quantity. We're not going to look at it for 3 or 4 months, and now we're inside that commitment window. Oh, wait, our clinical assumptions have changed. Do we still really need to make all that? Well, we've already committed we're going to spend that money, and then you end up making stuff that you don't use, and that's a big trigger of waste. So developing a business process where you're incorporating both commitment windows, understanding your planning horizons, as well as understanding your cost of goods so you understand the trade-offs involved, really helpful strategies for being able to communicate accurate budgets and trying to, again, minimize waste from a cost side as well as from an inventory side.
Matt, you're on the other side of those commitments usually. Do you want to respond or?
Take that, Matt. Yeah.
I keep going back to the, it's that partnership, going back and forth, having the conversations. I mean, it's those simple things that do get overlooked. It's like there is a relationship. There is the need to be able to call someone and say, I have a question. I need your help. I need your input. It's like being able to build that bridge early and know that it's there for when those problems do come up or there's challenges. And I mean, one thing, I mean, if you look at the CDMOs, they're dealing with tens to hundreds of products every year, and they may be thinking of some things that could actually help you just from their experience too. So,
yeah, and maybe one point just to jump in and build on both Mike's point and Matt's point is that I was talking about these commitment windows. When you build a relationship in the spirit of true partnership and collaboration, you'll often get more flexibility from your CDMOs than may what be explicitly stated in a master services agreement or a work order. Like mm-hmm. there's real value in that approach beyond just, we're saying we're gonna partner to say we're gonna partner, but when you actually need to make those changes and work outside the boundaries of your contracts, you'll get that reciprocity.
And it's not just about when are you making the batches, it's reservations fees to secure sure. a slot. It's mm-hmm. raw materials that have to be bought up front. And our strategy is to have a portfolio with strategic vendors. So we also want to build flexibility that if we have one product, we have two or three products with the CMO that we're able to change out when we're doing one product or another product to make some substitutions and also leverage raw materials. We want to be able to do that as well. And the CMOs look at that as an advantage for them on their behalf as well.
Yeah. Pooling supplies can come into play throughout the supply chain.
So, yeah, I agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to add anything more when you think of budget constraints, risk planning?
One thing I want to add is real quick is people outside of tech ops don't really get what we do that well. And creating that awareness is very important all the way up to the CFO and the CEO. So the earlier we're able to create that awareness and everyone understands what our goal is and what we're trying to achieve and the complexity associated with that, how long it is associated with that, the more process development, supply chain, manufacturing, regulatory, CMC, ClinOps get on board and they understand the environment that we're dealing with and how to work together as a team. The other one is accountability. So we have in our company very clear accountability of who is the face to the CMO and how we channel communication internally with the CMO, how we operate with the CMO, and how we exchange information with the CMO. And that's something that we feel is important as well.
Perfect. All right, we're gonna step into some of this internal relationship. So the relationship with clinical development, ClinOps, and what it means to get involved early. Brittany, you had started on that topic. Do you want to continue?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, so just again, focusing on the early phase aspect, because I feel like it is very unique. Coming in, I was the first supply chain hire, and you know, there wasn't anyone really doing forecasting. There was someone in clinical development kind of making those calculations and telling CMC what to produce. And I just realized pretty quickly early on that they don't understand the nuances of say like, oh, a patient's gonna get 15 tablets over a period of time, but the bottles contain 30 and they were just assuming two bottles or one bottle would satisfy two patients and not really understanding that like that goes home and the rest is waste. So just small education like that and trying to kind of take ownership of that proactiveness and inserting myself into those conversations when people were talking about hypothetical trials or variations and putting myself in there and saying, let me run the numbers for you. You tell me what the assumptions are. Please don't calculate that on your own. That is something supply chain needs to own. So I think when you're later phase, you've established that function and everybody kind of understands, but when you come into a company really early and they're not used to working with that person, it can kind of be a little bit of an education. So
this is the art versus the science yeah. part, right? You're hearing where the title came from. Yeah. Deb, do you want to add some perspective on this interrelationship building?
Indeed. It's so important to have that bridge. The ClinOps is planning where the study's going to be, how big the study's going to be, how fast the enrollment's going to go, or what they hope the speed of the enrollment will be. And all of that information needs to feed into what you're making for API right at the outset. Sometimes your regulatory batches will be more than enough, but there are many cases where they are not, depending on how fast those studies are going to enroll. So there needs to be that connection. And if it doesn't exist in your company to make that connection, then lean on your CMO to help you with that connection, to help ask the right questions so that when you're plotting your production batches, you're planning them early enough, right? There's that lead time that you need to take into account, and otherwise you end up in a rationing situation. So it's so critical to really think about all those different pieces and the questions that Brittany was talking about that you need to ask, and doing that math where you're starting to understand not just what the patient needs, but what you need to store at the site and what you need to store at the depot, and how many depots are you going to have. Are you going to have to worry about temperature excursion? So all those things need to come into play in that math.
Yeah, I just want to jump on the lead time aspect, because another thing that I've seen is, you know, companies run one trial, they've seen the lead times for the API and DP, and they kind of then assume, oh, that time it was 6 months, so ongoing it's always 6 months. So a little bit of education around that, you know, we're talking about a different batch size. We have to lock in the manufacturing slot. Like, it's on different equipment now, and it's not the exact same lead time every time that you can just kind of plug and chug for API and drug product as you're moving through the different phases of the trial.
I think, you know, to add to this too, let's also not forget the CMC teams. And I think sometimes we take for granted that there will be strong communication within a CMC team. Can't tell you how many times I've seen a batch and the yield was half of what we thought it was because of a sampling strategy that we weren't aware of, mm-hmm. right? And so I think there's an educational component as well, not just with sort of external internal stakeholders like clinical operations, but oftentimes with your analytical and formulation development teams, with your drug substance leads, to say, here are the inputs that really matter to us, here's why, let's make sure we're reviewing those going into production, re-reviewing those coming out of production, and reassessing the assumptions that are going into our plan. I think, you know, to kind of summarize, not only do planners have to be highly analytical, but to be great teachers and great communicators as well. It's kind of alternating between those hats. It's part of what makes the job so fun. It's also part of what makes the job so challenging.
Mike, I know when we talked earlier, you had mentioned maybe some thoughts around this relationship and how it lends to, like, validation timing and pulling through kind of on process validation. Are we ringing a bell?
Yes, a little bit. So when we get a molecule out of a lab, our process development team is thoroughly involved with looking at the manufacturability of that molecule and how that works. And in the early phase, you know, preclinical phase, we're focused on speed to IND. How can we get that IND filed as quickly as possible? I'm sure many of you probably work at companies where you have goals of how many INDs you're going to do this year, right? And you have the development of that, you have the tech transfer, you have the regulatory strategy associated with that, all the authoring associated with that, and so forth and so on. And you know, when you're able to get that IND, that gives you opportunities in the company. In some cases, your company might be very small and your intent is to get that IND or work with a partner who filed that IND, and then you're able to proceed, you know, further. We all don't have a bottomless amount of money that we can spend. We all have budgets that we have to tie to and investors that we have to please. So, you know, it's a little bit of an art on how we do that and what we want to do internally versus what we want to work with other people to help us out with.
So I'm just going to go down the table. What other thoughts do you want to make sure you share with this group when you think about some of the challenges, strategies you have in this space? Open question, and then be ready with your questions out there. We have some time for Q&A.
Just make sure, what time are we supposed to go to? Okay. I almost even follow on with Mike's a little bit of, if your goal is to file an IND, it's like, well, what's the big picture goal? Sometimes it pays to have that conversation. Is the goal to take the molecule all the way to the market yourself? Is the goal to partner with another company to take the molecule to market? Or is it to get a proof of concept and sell the molecule? So it's like knowing what the end goal is also helps like with your formulation strategy. I mean, like Brittany said, there's like tons of API. But what you do with that precious API, it's like, do you, if you're going to a tablet, you're going to have to do a lot more testing. You're going to have to use up a lot of API for that. But is there a way to come up with a strategy, again, talking to your CMO, of saying, what can we do maybe to say, let's do a granulation, put it into a capsule that would use the same excipients that you'd use in a tablet, so your excipient compatibility works, but you're a little further along. So just, again, just always kind of, I know we rush sometimes to, we want to get the IND filed, we want to get the clinic started, but it's like, well, there's a lot of work that goes around formulation, and if you can get some stability done early, get some things done, it can really save you a lot down the road.
Yeah, but to build on Matt's point too, as far as the risk, you know, really thinking about where do those risks sit, and if those happen, what are your mitigation strategies, and making use of, there's tons of very cool, interesting technology today. But you got to have the expertise, and you got to put the technology and the expertise together to be able to ask the right questions of the technology. So it's putting those two pieces together.
Do you want to start with any questions from the audience?
Good morning. Thanks, everyone. This is great stuff. I'm Paul Haynes. I'm a co-founder for Beacon Biopharm Associates. We provide supply chain to pre-IND companies in a lot of cases. One of the challenges they've seen is they manufacture it offshore, and they try to bring API into the US pre-IND to make that drug product batch. Mm-hmm. What strategies have you seen to successfully do that?
I actually went through that this past year and was introduced to the import for export filing in that. So I think talking with your CMO who's doing the shipping and the receiving and working with their, you know, experts in the brokerage team with whatever courier you're using to really understand like how to get that drug in. I know there's a lot of CMOs too that are over the border in Canada that have open locations so that you can ship to them first. And then once you do have your finished drug, it's a lot easier to get it into the US if that's your plan pre actually having the IND filed. So that's something that we've explored.
There is good news. There's like in December, there's a new guidance. It's like 66-66. And it's if you've had the conversations with FDA mm-hmm. about filing IND and you have a conversation number, you can bring in the API and do the work without having to do the import for export. Okay. So instead of saving yourselves ship your drug product out and ship it back.
Yeah.
That's like brand new too. So.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Paul.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. I think clinical supply chain doesn't get enough attention, so I appreciate this. Heather Erickson most recently was saying about therapeutics and set up a lot of our supply chain function. I'm curious to know what form of, if any, S&OP or maybe DNOP, because there's no sales yet, process you use. Who do you involve outside of tech ops, and how frequently do you provide executive visibility to this? Just recognizing that there's a lot of conversation here about education and communication, and kind of how soon do you pull programs into that type of process?
Yeah, maybe I can jump on this one first. So we actually have two tiers of an S&OP-like process in the clinical space. So we have an operational, we call it clinical demand and operations planning. This is specifically between our supply chain leads and our clinical operation leads, focused really on the demand inputs. So really reviewing each clinical trial, projected enrollment rates, site activation schedule, screen failure, all the inputs that Bill was referring to earlier. What's gonna really drive our demand forecast and what changes are we seeing? We do that on a monthly basis. Then on the supply side within the operation space, we have a connection with the tech ops folks, our drug product leads, drug substance leads, analytical leads, to really review all of the inputs that are going in on the supply planning side. And that process culminates in us publishing a production plan. Then the second tier of this is, we call this more of a strategic clinical demand and operations planning process, where there we're bringing in executives from the clinical operations space and the technical operations space to review the drug substance and drug product plan specifically. There we're assessing some of those more complex analyses that I mentioned earlier around low case and high case, what are some of the trade-offs between risk and cost that we're making to gain endorsement on the plans that we're pursuing. I think the challenge with that in the clinical space is, unlike commercial, there's not a sort of rhyme and rhythm with clinical. There are often changes to the clinical development plan or to supply strategies, and we have to conduct these meetings more on an ad hoc basis. But being able to get the buy-in from leadership, this is why it's important, because we're committing millions of dollars and we want everyone to understand the assumptions and the trade-offs. So that way, 6 or 12 months from now, if we do have to throw out a batch, we can look back and say, here's why we made the decision that we made.
Yeah, similar, my last company, we were moving from phase three to commercial. So it was kind of what Ryan was talking about, but just me basically meeting with ClinOps to align on the demand plan pretty much weekly. And then again, the CMC tech ops function to align on the supply plan. And then we had like a CMC task force that was all the leaders that we would kind of use as the more executive strategic decision making, but I wouldn't say it was a formalized process written anywhere as an SOP. We were only looking into that as we approached commercialization for like a formal written, but we had one trial, one program, so it wasn't necessarily something that I felt was needed.
I think, you know,
for you and for everyone, we actually did a webinar on this topic out of the work stream, and it's probably recorded somewhere because it was quite a hot topic. We kind of discussed this. Someone else wanted to add in.
You know, say customers like Ryan are a dream, you know, that have their future planning. That's not the case, unfortunately, with all the customers. And so we find we end up working an awful lot to help the customer think about what might be happening 6 months or 12 months down the line so that we can help you. Yeah.
I've got a question for you. You heard me earlier talk about silos. And so my question is, what role should supply chain play with respect to a decision that may occur in a silo about how many years of stability studies to have for date extension? What role does supply chain play in terms of identifying how and when to roll out a formulation change?
I have an opinion. It's our job to understand that. Mm-hmm. It's your job as a supply chain leader to understand the inputs that impact your plan. Mm-hmm. I really think it's that simple. And then you have to be vocal about it. And that goes back to my earlier point about speaking up and the educational point. A lot of CMC folks don't understand what the inputs are that impact our plan. A lot of folks outside of CMC definitely don't understand the impacts of their inputs on our plan. It's our job, it's our responsibility, our accountability to do that education and to share with them, this is what we need from you and when. We need to be at the table in these decisions, and then we need to speak up and share either an endorsement or a concern or a risk that we see for the team to consider.
Questions. We have a few minutes, so according to my watch, Bill, I'm not going to watch it.
And I still think, Brittany, your 30 tablets in one bottle for two patients, that's just a supply chain problem. it's logistics.
Yeah, you just get them to live in the same house for a while.
So thank you, guys. This is very insightful. My name is Neeraj. I'm from Boston Insights. We are a technology company and was trying to solve a lot of these problems that exist today. So my question is very simple. How can technology help to make things better? So we talked about collaboration, we talked about visibility, things happening in silos. What do you guys think, how can technology help in making things, improving things and improving the speed? Thank you.
I can give an example of one technology that I was going to talk about in the next session, but one of the things that our clinical team is working on is starting to make use of the enrollment data that exists. There is reams and reams and reams of it. We have a lot of knowledge in all the different therapeutic areas all over the globe. When you start to put that into AI and take advantage of the data that exists across many, many, many trials, you start to get a more accurate enrollment picture. So now you know where your patients are going to be and how fast you're going to enroll them with a little more accuracy based on that, you know, AI overlay. that starts to help the planning upstream as far as where does this material need to go? Where do we need to have the specifications? Where do we need to file the regulatory and in what order? You can start to plan for that earlier. So there's a really important technology that's way downstream, but if you can get that intel early and bring it upstream, it's fantastic and powerful.
I think to add on to that, we built some in-house tools. So we have a tool that we built in-house that all of clinical ops will enter their protocols, and that gets updated on a quarterly basis, and we monitor all the changes associated with that, and then that drives what we do for planning. The $1 million question that we have is, what overage do we account for? If I have 50 clinical sites that I'm gonna do a trial at across the world, what do I put where? In some cases, we have like 300% overage. So, you know, for every vial, I have to make three extra vials. That's a lot of investment that a company has to do. So how can we crack the code on getting a more scientific understanding of what it should be, and how do we reduce that waste? I think that's one of the topics we have coming up, right? So, yes.
And I think, Mike, to add to that, it's like a balance between time and resources from supply chain on, like, trying to avoid as much waste as possible and being really, like, you know, diligent about looking at the patients coming in and approaching it from the other side of, well, I'm just gonna plan for all this overage so then I don't have to worry as much and put as much time and attention into where patients are going so that I'm covered. So it's like a trade-off, like either financially or resource-wise, where you wanna spend your time.
And I think that works in certain situations. Yeah. We had a flu drug that had a 6-week enrollment period. Yeah. You have to plan it all up front. Yeah. The drug has to be at the site before the trial starts. Yeah, totally. So you're kind of, if you have a 48-week regimen, that's a totally different story, right? Yeah. So it's kind of a case-by-case basis, I think.
Thank you, guys. I think that you have a topic for next year's planning discussion. How can technology help?
We're moving very seamlessly into the next topic. Do we want to
quit while we're ahead?
Do we want to take one more question?
All right, I'll throw another one at you.
Thanks, Bill.
Give him the microphone.
PQ lots, validation lots, whatever you want to call them. What is the art, because I assume that there is more art to science, in determining how big those lots should be and how are you going to use every drop of it?
Yeah, I mean, this is the connection between commercial and clinical supply chain, right? And this is where that link must exist, and it must exist as you're beginning to plan your validation lots, right? As you start getting into like commercial demand forecasting and market size estimates and whatnot, but there's going to be a range. There's going to be an estimate of how much annual commercial demand there's going to be that's really going to inform what a practical commercial batch size is going to be. And then there has to be a conversation if it's two different roles. We'll talk about this in having one organization, one function or two functions, or having a single product owner. Like I know that was a strategy that was mentioned that Rob Tenerowitz brought up yesterday, which is a valuable approach specifically for this problem. But there has to be that connection between, okay, if we're making PQ lots, what is the launch strategy? How much of that is allocated for commercial demand? Is there going to be leftover for clinical supply? If there's not, do we need to make more clinical batches before we launch? So on and so forth. There's a whole strategic analysis that goes into that.
Yeah, agreed. We involve the contract manufacturer in that as well to look at options, because the contract manufacturers we work with have multiple sites around the world, and they have different scales that we can accommodate, so we involve them with that as well. And commercial, you know, we're talking to commercial on things that we're not going to launch for like 3 or 4 years, just so we can understand what does that look like, and when we're having an agreement with the CMO, we're giving them that type of information up front so they understand what the market potential for the product is going to be as well.
And I felt like regulatory has a huge voice in that too, like as far as what they feel like is justifiable to the FDA, and that's what we ran into. And then it was a, like Ryan said, kind of a negotiation between, okay, we need three batches of each, and I'm looking in the commercial forecast, and for one of the SKUs that's like 8 weeks of supply, so that's fine, but for the other two that's like a year and we only have 12 months dating, so a lot of that's going to go to waste, and that's kind of what we're signing up for. So just being able to present that to your executive team and saying this is what you're inheriting with these plans.